Welcome to Taking the Rams by the Horns, a podcast that takes current affairs out of current affairs. This is a podcast in partnership with Sowetan Live. I'm your host, Rams Mabote. South Africa is alive with possibilities. I mean, who would have imagined a former president in jail? A sitting president sleeping on cash, literally. A cabinet minister visiting a common prisoner in jail. Or even the post office operating, even when they have nothing to do.
Can you confirm that delivery performances dropped?
Welcome to the new Sowetan Live podcast called Taking the Rams by the Horns with me, Rams Mabote. Each week, I will be taking a lighter look at very serious topics that half the time drive you up the wall. This podcast will use humor to take no prisoners, have no holy cows, and cook a whole lot of sacrificial lambs. One of the most distinguished features of politics in the African continent is nepotism. In this beloved continent of ours, it is not strange to have someone as president, their son as Minister of Defense or the Police, their wife or daughter as Minister of Finance, and their brother as Minister of Home Affairs. Sometimes, just for kicks, they would even have their concubine as a minister too, even if it is a Minister of Fisheries in a landlocked country. Politics seems to be our only answer to business empires of other worlds, where we have seen stuff like Aqualaya and Sons or Cats and Family. These family businesses have been known to thrive for generations and make money for their respective families. So has politics in some of the countries on this continent. Just when you thought South Africa is better than that, you wake up in a country where we have a Minister of Electricity as a Ramokopa, Treasurer General and a Deputy Secretary of the Governing Party also as Ramokopas. And while you're still trying to make peace with the fact that not only are these three not siblings or husband and wife or wives, you wake up to another Ramokopa in the room. But before you get excited, wait. This new entrance is not only not related to the former three, she's also in opposition to the African National Congress. In fact, she wants us to help her to remove the ANC from power. Her name is Vuyiswa Ramokopa, and she's national chairperson of the New Kids on the Block, Rise Mzansi, and premier candidate of the party for Gauteng. But who on earth is Vuyiswa Ramokopa? What makes her tick? What brings her into politics, and why should me and the citizens of Gauteng consider her to be the next boss of Amapanyaza? Well, there is no better time than now to find out. And I couldn't have chosen a better time to have her in my studio than on the eve of Rise Mzansi's first birthday. The party turns one on Friday. Well, Vuyiswa Ramokopa, ni Mutsekwane, is an experienced entrepreneur and business leader with over 15 years experience across various industries, including retail, marketing, design, events management, and property investment. Maybe there's more. She didn't have space to write more. She has also held various listed private and non-profit board roles. She holds a BCom in politics, philosophy, and economics from UCT and has completed executive programs with Gibbs and Oxford University, that which we call a better black. Having founded her first business in 2009, a retail clothing boutique in downtown Johannesburg, I'm sure she doesn't go there anymore, Vuyiswa has subsequently started and led several businesses and held senior leadership roles in the corporate and non-profit sector. As CEO of the SA Institute of Black Property Practitioners, she was responsible for driving various initiatives aimed at transforming the South African property sector, promoting the increased participation of youth and women in capacitating entrepreneurs. In 2020, she was elected as the inaugural chairperson of the National Property Practitioners Council. She has also served as a member of the Black Business Council National Council since 2018, was member of the BRICS Women's Business Alliance Executive Committee, and in 2018 founded Women on the Rise, a voluntary association aimed at increasing the voice of women in policy decision-making. She clearly likes the word rise. She is an alumnus of the 2018 Fortune 500 Vital Voices. Guys, can you hear this biography? Like, this person wants to be a politician, right? I mean, I'm reading a, like, something in the stock exchange somewhere. I mean, U.S. Global Mentoring Program and a recipient of the 2011 Destiny Magazine Top 40, Under 40, blah, 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 2018 Young Independence. Yo, this person. I mean, where does it say she stole money somewhere and then she was like she lived in a shack? Like, Vuyiswa is passionate about economic and spatial justice and empowerment of youth and women and the development of the African continent. She's also a wife and a mother of three. Now, why does that sound like an afterthought? It comes right at the end of her biography that she's a wife and a mother of three. Ah, she doesn't like her family, this one. Warmest welcome to the bravest woman in town. Not only is she putting her name in the hat to challenge the incumbent Panyaza Lesufi, she's also taking on EFF's Dr. Mbuyiseni Ndlovu and DA's Solim Simang. Now, not only are the three well-known in their own right, they also have significant failures under their belt. Lesufi failed as a football boss, Ndlozi as an IS boy, and Msimang, well, he's the remaining top black leader who has failed to quit the party. Today, I hope not only to find out who this woman is in front of me, but if she wants to make it to the top of the Gauteng political game, I hope she tells me where she has failed at least once. I mean, her competitors have failed. This is a very important criterion in our provincial politics. Hello, Vuyiswa.
Hello, Rams. It is an absolute pleasure to be here with you. I'm still trying to gather myself after
this.
That
is the
intro.
Longest intro I have ever written for any interview I've held, and I've had easily nothing less than 40,000 interviews since 1993. So this is the longest, right? So, because I wanted to find out, why the hell are you getting into politics? What's wrong with you?
Well, Rams, the truth is, I didn't choose this journey.
Yeah.
This journey has chosen me.
Sound like a pastor now.
It's a fact. Our country is quite obviously in a state of crisis. And, you know, myself and my fellow leaders within Rise Mzansi are of a similar generation. We are a generation that had the benefit of watching this democracy being born. You know, we are not Matuke.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not Lituke, yeah. But there are Matuke within us, you
yes.
know. But the beauty of our generation is that we did get to see this democracy being born. We got to see the first decade of South Africa as the jewel of not just the continent, but the world, you mm-hmm. know, and a shining example of what a post-democratic African country could look like.
Yeah.
And then also got to witness the beginning of the decline of our country, not just economic decline, but also social and moral decline that we have seen happening over the last two decades. And in reflecting on this and really reflecting on our role as young professionals, as business leaders, as thought leaders, because the leadership of Rise Mzansi is made up of people from different spaces, civil society, business, academia, and so on, you know. And in reflecting on that, we said, surely there is a role that people like us need to be playing. And that role, unfortunately, can no longer be just as part of the commentariat, you know, the people who sit in the stands and point fingers and feel better about ourselves because they are worse people than us in the political arena. We realized
that
this time...
That feels like a snide attack on people like who do podcasts.
No,
and like,
not
know,
at all,
podcasts,
not at all.
Right, you know, those kind of people,
it's
I know some of them.
It's all of us.
Okay.
We sit on Twitter, we sit on Facebook, we comment all the time about everything that's wrong in politics,
yep.
about the poor state of leadership that we have. But then we never are able to answer the question that says, okay, so if you don't want them, then who do we want?
Yeah.
And where must those people come from? And the reality is that we know these people. We know incredible leaders across different industries and sitting in all walks of life and across the age spectrum, the race spectrum, etc. But clearly, those people are just not finding their way into the political arena.
Mm.
And so this was the juncture that I also got to. And I said, you know, one needs to be the change that you want to see. I want to see better quality leadership in our politics. And I can't expect somebody else to do it if I myself am not willing. So we started the journey towards building a platform that will enable and attract a better quality of leadership and restore the state of leadership into our political arena. And just as a last point, before I get accused of Huigeza Bitir, I think it's important to state that our perspective on leadership is not limited to simply having quote-unquote political credentials.
Yeah.
It's one thing to have been in politics for the last 30 years, and we're not undermining that. I think that's important to some extent. But in a country like ours, in an economy like ours that is as complex as it is, in a, you know, technology is moving at an absolutely exponential rate, the business is changing, everything is changing so fast, we are better off having a dynamic and diverse cohort of leaders contributing to policymaking in our country. Mm-hmm. And so it's our view, again, that we need to have the kind of public sector and the kind of politics that attracts people from all walks of life, and that we are all able to come and apply our skills. When you get tired of podcasting, you can also then say, you know what, I'm ready to serve my city or my province, and I would like to put my name in the hat.
In an SOE, maybe, because I can steal a few rands.
The stealing must stop, Rams.
But, you know, I mean, I could only attribute your bravery to the fact that part of you grew up in Hillbrow. You know, somebody who grows up there should be so brave to do anything strange. Right? How was it growing up in that part? At least you moved up there at some point after being born in a rougher spot than Hillbrow.
Yeah,
at the
sure. So I was born in Hillbrow. And interestingly enough, this Hillbrow that you speak of, this rough, you know, streets of Hillbrow, it wasn't like that.
It was not like that, I'm sure. Yeah. It was lived there.
Yeah.
Between 1994 and 96,
you
I
see,
lived in Hillbrow.
So, and it was a very different place at the time. And it's also, again, just a testament to the decay, not just of our inner cities, but I think of the province as a whole, you know. It was world class at the time. I used to play in Joubert Park. We lived in Smith Street. I was a child, and as a child, one could just walk across the street and go play in Joubert Park freely. Of course, Johannesburg has always been, an urbanized area. There's always been an element of crime here and there, but certainly not the level of decay that we now see in Hillbrow. So, but in saying that, I will say that I've had the benefit of traveling a lot. I've lived in different cities. I've worked in the kinds of industries that required me to travel. And I do think being born in Johannesburg, being bred in Johannesburg, prepares you for anywhere in the world. If you've made it through Joburg and you've made it through living in Gauteng, you can tackle anything.
If we stop this conversation right here, I'd be the happiest person. But anyway, let's continue. I mean, wouldn't it be easier to just stay making money in proper white monopoly capital than, as opposed to being in what they accuse you of, in white monopoly capital funded politics?
Sure. Short answer is yes. I did not come into the space because of lack of options. I was running my own property investment entity, sitting on a number of boards, and it's easier, to just choose myself and choose my family. But it's also very concerning when you now start sitting around tables and having conversations with your peers and hearing about people who are not even just satisfied with that anymore. They're now looking at moving overseas, packing their families up and relocating because there's uncertainty for them about where this country is going to be going. There's a lot of people having those conversations, and it is not just white people. A lot of black people and people of various races are having those conversations and saying, why should I sit here and watch my, you know, spend 70% of my income on the combination? First, I pay tax, and then after paying tax, I must actually then go and pay for the things that my tax is supposed to be paying for. So at the end of the day, I pay 70% tax for what I earn. Mm. I'd rather go live somewhere else in the world where things actually function and I can pocket more and earn in dollars.
There are many parties who say that. So why Rise Mzansi and not them? I mean, why not MK Party?
I can categorically say MK Party has never said what I just said. Never. But
I suppose the gist of my question is that why not the other parties?
No, look, I mean, I think our theory of change is very simple. We understand our primary challenge to be a leadership crisis, as I've said to you. And in solving the leadership crisis, it requires us to be able to bring together the best from everywhere. And I think that's something that Rise Mzansi has done spectacularly well in comparison to our peers, even many of the established parties that currently exist. We have a leadership collective. We're not a one-man band, you know. I know people like to say, "Ke party amang." Who's the owner of that party?
Yeah, yeah.
There's no owner. We have a national leadership collective, a cohort of 25 people currently and growing. That includes the leaders of all 9 provinces, as well as those who are based in the national office. And each of them are people who are successful and accomplished in their own rights from their different industries. And I can assure you that if things were to, you know, end today, there would be people who would be highly employable in our economy or anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
And that is a critical differentiating factor, because it means we are not here simply to make a quick buck or to make a name for ourselves. The people who are here have had to sacrifice actually a lot. They've put their reputations on the line, their careers, thriving careers on the line to come and serve their country. And so where we come from, and I think that's, it's also pertinent to point out that we are not a breakaway of any political party.
Mm.
We don't come about as a function of having a public spat with another political party. It is a genuine collective of concerned citizens who said, what are we going to do to change the trajectory of this country? In that process, of course, we have people who have held office in other political parties, but that's not the genesis of where we come from. And I think that also gives us the room to be able to really think innovatively and not being encumbered by the culture of another political organization. I mean, some people can't even come up with an original name. Like, they literally have to go and steal the name from a place that they came from.
I actually just laughed like that. Anyway.
And I'm saying, I gotta be, but I'm just saying, you know, at the point when your whole basis is thinking around is the past and the party that you came from, how can we trust you to be able to come up with a credible, coherent vision for the future? And that is what Rise Mzansi is absolutely obsessed with, is about the next 30 years and how we create a generational, you know, a trajectory for the next generation in, you know, over the next 30 years.
Well, let's talk about Gauteng.
Yeah.
The province you want to lead, province of me and 8 million other people.
Yeah.
You know, what's wrong with Gauteng? Before we get to your plan,
sure.
What's wrong with Gauteng?
So there are a number of things that have gone wrong in the province over the last few the last few decades, actually. I'd say easily the last 2 decades. The one we've already touched on. The province is literally falling apart before our eyes. Infrastructure hasn't been maintained. It is crumbling before our eyes. And this is all manner, whether you're talking about sewerage, water infrastructure, don't have to talk about electricity, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got massive issues of infrastructure in Gauteng, and it's dilapidating. But number two is obviously a huge one, very visible as well. Crime and grime. Like, we are still one of the most unsafe places to be in the country. And that is obviously exacerbated by the physical dirt that you just see building up all around us. I mean, buildings literally crumble and collapse and or get set on fire, you know, just because they are neglected and hijacked and run down. So ultimately, these are some of the more visible things. But obviously then there's deeply embedded corruption in government across the board, provincial and local government. And again, it speaks to a failure of leadership, and it speaks to an unwillingness on the part of the current leadership to actually do something decisive to deal with corruption. I don't know of any high-profile corruption prosecutions that have happened, despite the fact that 148 people are dead after Life Esidimeni despite the fact that we have multiple, you know, during the COVID times, we had a number of cases where people were literally scooping up government funds with shovels, shoveling government funds, sanitizing empty classrooms for hundreds of millions of rand. Till this day, there has been zero accountability on where that money went to. And all the while, whilst education infrastructure, classrooms are not being built, children are sitting in overcrowded classrooms, etc. So I don't have to, quite honestly, I don't think I have to sit here and tell people what's wrong. We live here. We see it. We know what's wrong. The conversation we need to be having is, how do we move ourselves forward?
On that note, then, let's talk about your Tsoga Gauteng plan. By the way, you know, other people call these things manifestos. Like, you know, of course, others say, what is manifesto?
Yes.
And you chose to call it a plan. You know, you guys are too smart, man. You say in your plan, and I want to start right at the beginning, that we still live in functional group areas.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
So, and I'm glad that you started there, because I think that's also...
Because I read the plan.
Yes. Aye, good. It's at the core of why we have also failed to ignite our economy in the way that we have, because our challenges are often structural. And one of them is around the legacy of apartheid spatial planning, which we have not been able to address adequately. And in fact, have simply gone on to actually deepen and exacerbate those very same apartheid spatial planning patterns. And what do I mean by that? We all know, I don't have to again speak to this, but during, you know, that time, it was intended that African people and non-white people, as they define them, would live in far-flung areas, far away from the urban centers. And there was a reason for that. They wanted us far away, and they ensured that even in the town planning of townships, they were not designed to be bustling centers of economic opportunity.
Yeah.
You were meant to be in a form of enslavement, quite frankly, whereby you are forced to commute into the mines or the city and get yourself back and go and sleep in your labor dormitory. That is what they were designed for. So in thinking around how do we then create a much more just, a much more equitable and productive city and productive province, it starts with that. So we have to start by saying, one, how do we connect people closer to each other? Apartheid brought us further. How do we bring ourselves now back together and have much more inclusive cities? And not just inclusive in terms of the color of our skin, but inclusive mixed income, mixed economy type of developments and settlements, right? So that's the first pillar, in fact, of our 5C plan.
The,
and we talk about connecting people.
Yeah. And that's not reconnecting as community.
No, it's connecting people to economic opportunities. It's connecting the different far-flung areas of the province to each other through having affordable public transport. Because again, that is one of the biggest barriers for people to be able to create economic opportunity or for people to have economic mobility. They spend 40% on average of their income on public transport. Mm. That is the average Gauteng resident. It's about 50 rand a day thereabout to actually commute in and out. So at some point, it even becomes too expensive for people to go to work. I encountered a lady who said she quit her job because she was spending basically her entire salary just to get to work. So it didn't make sense for her. She may as well sit at home. So one is around building better inclusive settlements and actually looking at areas where infrastructure already exists. So we don't need to go and build mega cities on the outskirts in the most furthest part of Gauteng. We don't need to do that. That can come later. But we currently sit with buildings that are vacant or that are falling apart in our inner cities. Government should be looking at those buildings and looking at the land that we have that is close to economic opportunities and saying, how do we replan? Where we need to expropriate using our existing powers as the state, they must do that. where they need to.
Half of those properties are owned by guys we don't know.
That's what I'm saying. But the law allows us.
Very scary guys.
The law.
Are you going to tackle those guys?
No, it's not. It's the government.
I'm scared of those guys.
I'm not. I'm not scared of those guys because the state has every right, both in terms of the constitution, but number two, in terms of the number of different vehicles available and mechanisms available. So, and I like that you use the term scared because we often like to use the term political will. That's a fancy way of saying people are scared.
Yeah.
They are scared to do the hard things that need to be done. Leadership in general is about making hard choices and about reconciling that there are going to be people who are not going to be happy with your choices. But you have to do what has to get done for the greater good of the people and the residents. So I think that's one area. It's really reversing the legacy of apartheid spatial planning by doing proper development and investing in public transport. And there I'm talking about rail infrastructure mm-hmm. as well as buses. We need proper public transport, not private transport that is transporting the public.
In fact, if you say that, one could argue that we actually do not have any
we
public
don't.
Transport. All of it is private.
Correct.
From taxis up to Rea Vaya, they're all private, sponsored by, some of them sponsored by government.
Look, some of it is somewhat subsidized, but the collapse of the passenger rail system is probably one of the biggest hindrances to economic growth, not just in the province, but I think nationally. It is the cheapest, most effective form. And if you speak to, I mean, I was chatting to my mom just yesterday. We were at the Oriental Plaza. And my mom also is born and bred in Joburg. And she used to say, you know, Karina Kotsawana, they used to take the train
yes.
and get off at Bramfontein Station and walk around, you know, and
go to the... I took the train for 6 years going to school.
Go to the yeah. movies and yeah. all of that stuff. And I'm saying, we haven't had that pleasure as children born in democracy. That is appalling, in my opinion. And we have to restore that.
Is it restorable? Look at the rail infrastructure and you think, now we have dwellings on the rail tracks. It would mean that, and you spoke about unpopular decisions, you have to move people out of that to recover the rail infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely. That is what you have to do. And it's, you know, it's that broken window syndrome, yeah. Rams, is that a lot of the things that happen not because it doesn't happen overnight, right? It happens slowly. So you're talking about people living on rails and whatever. If it had been dealt with decisively on day one, it wouldn't have been an option for more people to come. But the reality is that it was allowed to happen. There was no management of it. There was no maintenance of that infrastructure. Of course, people are going to live there. Same thing with informal settlements. It starts as one or two or a couple of handful of people. If you do nothing about it, don't be surprised when 100 more people come. And then, of course, then it becomes impossible to relocate 1,000 families. But we have to deal with things at the start, before they become an issue. Let me give you another example of a new phenomenon in our province. Cable theft.
Yeah. It's not so new.
Yeah, it's not so new. But it's now at a whole new level. The traffic lights, the robots now, they literally come and cut them. So at first it used to just be stealing cables, then the city would replace, and then now they come and they cut them, and the city does what? The city then says, well, we're now not going to put a new robot here. So we have massive intersections that now sit with no traffic lights. And you have guys who are abusers of drugs or whatever, homeless people who now are directing traffic instead of just managing the problem of cable theft, which is what we should have been dealing with in the first place.
Okay, let's move on to the second C. You touched on it a bit earlier, somebody who could have been a clean hillbrow. And in the plan, you speak about how dilapidated the province has become, but you speak about cleanliness also from a different perspective.
Yeah.
You speak about cleanliness from how people govern with their fingers in the jar and yeah, stuff like
yeah.
that. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, I often say this and I'll say it again. We are not a poor country. In fact, statistically and globally, we are regarded as a middle-income country. So we are not a poor country. We are a country that is poorly managed and poorly led by people who would far rather, waste the ample resources we have or steal the ample resources we have than direct them towards where they need to go.
If I'm right, Gauteng is the fourth biggest economy in the continent.
Third. Third, as I understand it, and obviously biggest in South Africa.
Yeah.
So, but yet we are now seeing people semigrating to other parts of the country. This is the biggest economy in South Africa, and corruption is actually a crime against the state. It is a crime against the state. We must call it what it is. It is people who are not just stealing from the fiscus and from us today, but literally stealing our children's future. Because when you go and inflate the cost of an infrastructure project, I think the recent figure that I saw was that our infrastructure, we lost about 101 million rand just on infrastructure, that like wasted money for infrastructure, basically. And I'm saying, now, that's not 100 million rand just that we're stealing today, because infrastructure is built for the next generation. Yep. You invest now to reap the benefits in the future generation. So what this effectively means is that today someone pockets that money, 10 years from now, your children don't have adequate infrastructure and are drinking infected water because water is not being maintained or whatever it may be. And so my point is that corruption is an absolute pandemic that we have to deal with unapologetically. And our contention, and I will say this boldly, is that the problem cannot be solved by the people who have caused the problem. It can't. The people whose hands are currently in the cookie jars and whose entire livelihoods are basically dependent on this ecosystem of corruption and on procurement and on, it cannot be solved by them. And this is why we need new leaders who are not currently involved in this system. And it is only new leaders who would be able to have the political will to make those hard choices that I'm talking about.
You know, I hope people will understand me. I want you to become premier because I want to interview you 3 years into your leadership. Because I have come to a space where I think corruption has far passed the political realm.
Yeah.
It's now a culture in the country. Mm-hmm. And it manifests itself in things that we take for granted.
Sure.
Like when you go park in a building where there are security guards who are full-time employed, mm-hmm. but they still extort money from you.
Mm-hmm.
But you have corruption now with public servants. These are not politicians. Now, these are guys who will not pay my invoice because they want...
Who won't issue you a driver's license that you've passed fair and square,
right?
Without you paying.
So we can get rid of 400 legislators in the National Assembly or whatever the number is in Gauteng when you come in and you bring your own. But the system is such that it's going to take you forever to change that. And I would like to call you 3 years later and say, I don't think you're winning.
Let me tell you something. The problem that we have is that it starts from the top. The fish rots from the head, Rams. You are never going to be able to tell me, a low-paid civic servant, that I mustn't take a little fat off the top when I can see the guys who are earning millions, stealing millions, hiding millions in their couches, having corruption charges that are read in billions. Those ones don't even steal a little bit. They steal in billions.
Yeah.
So it is about a lack of leadership and the tone that is set already at that level. But it's also about people witnessing accountability happening. If we had a couple of high-profile corruption prosecutions and you actually started to see a premier going to jail, a president going to jail, then it sends a very clear message that if people who are powerful at that level can be held accountable, then what of me? And I think we must not just accept culture as this thing, amorphous thing that happens outside of us. It doesn't happen outside of us. That tone gets set by leadership. If you walk into, and you know where you see this, is that we all are able to we behave differently when we are in different spaces and places. So when you could today in South Africa, in fact, South Africa is a good example. I know that when I'm in Gauteng, or when we're in Gauteng, and you get stopped by policemen, you know that it is possible to potentially talk your way out of that
yeah.
roadblock.
Yeah.
But there may be other parts of the province where you don't feel as bold.
Mm-hmm.
And you know for a fact that this conversation, yeah, Georgia, won't fly.
Yeah.
And so it's not you that's corrupt, or you are able to assimilate to your environment. And I'm saying we change the environment, but it starts with the tone being set by leadership and by seeing now some serious accountability happening at the top. Not just here in the small hundred thousands that are being stolen.
That afro will be completely grey before the end of your term.
Hey,
in trying to deal with that stuff. So, create is your third C, and here you're focusing on this economy and creating jobs. Now, I get scared when I hear politicians talking about creating jobs. I mean, I've heard a few here from 9 million to sure. 2 million. Everybody who comes into the studio and creates jobs. How many are you creating?
So I just want to make it very clear that our definition of creating jobs is not me sitting in an office and writing on a piece of paper jobs. Because I'm not going to pull jobs out of my pocket as the premier. I can't decide I'm going to make a program and then hire 500,000 people. It doesn't work like that. Jobs are created when the economy is growing, right? And jobs get created from different parts of the economy. So I'll give you a very practical example. In 2022, we recorded, and it was statistically, we lost the creation of 300,000 jobs in Gauteng alone because of load shedding. So the cost of load shedding to the economy of Gauteng cost us 300,000 jobs. So a simple thing like dealing with a load shedding challenge already gives you a jobs bump. You can then say, tick, by fixing load shedding, we've created 300,000 jobs. Similarly, water, infrastructure, all of these things. These are the building blocks. And then I'm going
to... Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
And I've never had to ask anybody this question, so you get the privilege to get this stupid question from me. If that is the case, I would imagine the governing party would want to solve this and to create more jobs so that they stay in power, because the more jobs are created, people are happy, then they would also tick on the same box all the time they vote, right? I mean,
the governing party has no idea how to create jobs, none whatsoever. They think that jobs are created in an office and that jobs are only the programs that they themselves create. So when a government employee or public official talks about job creation, they are talking about the things that they themselves can fund out of their pockets as part of their programs. And then they want to then stand on stages and hand people jobs in stadiums. That's their idea of job creation. What they refuse to do is deal with the structural elements that contribute to a growing economy. And it's very clear. Nationally.
By the way, I did get the dig on Nasispani. I heard you very well. I didn't say it, but I heard it.
Yeah, so nationally, we are sitting at just under 1% GDP growth. You cannot create jobs. Employment doesn't come if you are not growing GDP.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be having businesses that are growing their output, that are growing their footprint, that are making increased investments, such that they are then able to employ. But then you also need to deal, like I said, with some of the structural and spatial issues. So you can't just say, I'm waving a magic wand and then we're making a township economy. You can't do that.
Mm.
Because an economy in a township requires certain fundamentals. Are you able to issue business rights adequately? How do business rights get issued? Through local planning authorities. They currently take north of 6 months. On a good day, it's 6 months. On average, it can take up to 3 years to get business rights for your business.
Mm.
In a township or anywhere, by the way.
Yeah.
Anywhere in Johannesburg, in Gauteng. So what must I do for those 3 years as a business? You know what then happens? I have to trade effectively illegally.
Legally.
Which means...
Or pay yourself into getting the rights,
yes,
right?
Somehow. Which hampers my ability to develop that. I can't build a building for myself because I don't have business rights. I can't go to the bank and get capital for my business because they want to see that I've got all the right documentation and I don't. Because why? The city's not giving me the rights that I need, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm saying there are structural, if you want to have an economy that's growing, you need to have an enabling environment for businesses at all levels to function. You need to make sure that there's safety. Safety is a massive issue for businesses. You know, yesterday we were in Fordsburg. And talking to business owners around Fordsburg, many of them have left. Many have left that area. That what used to be a bustling a part of our city has now dwindled because of armed robberies, cash in transit heists. People are just sick of being of violent crime and being targeted for violent crime, and we are unable to manage the crime and safety issue, not just in the province, but I think nationally. So my point is that these are the building blocks. You have to secure people's safety. You have to have electricity. No business can work without electricity. You have to ensure that, obviously, you need to ensure that you also have the right human capital, you know. So make sure that you are skilling people appropriately for the types of industries that you want to grow. It also doesn't help to have a whole lot of businesses like now we've got tech. If we say we want tech companies, you that build, bring all these tech companies here, but then you don't have people who have the skills to be able to take up the opportunities in those sectors. So we must make sure that there is an integration between skills training and what people are capacitated with and the industries that we're investing in long term. And this is a boring answer, Rams, because the
Yeah, all of you are boring guys, but I enjoy talking to politicians.
I'm saying this is a boring answer. I would far rather stand here and say to you, I'm going to give you 2 million jobs. Yeah, I'd love to say that. But the number that we've put, which is 600,000 jobs.
I wanted to talk about that number.
We've put a number in there, and it's a number that is very realistic. 600,000 jobs over a period of 5 years.
Okay.
Right? Now, that is realistic because what it does is it's actually based on the rest of the features of the plan also rolling out over a period of 5 years. If we can do all of the things that need to be done, it is our view that simply by getting, for example, electricity back on track, and we understand that's obviously a national function, but there are things that can be done at a local level, ensuring that, you know, transformers are functional, getting subsidizing households to get off grid, etc., etc. There are things that can be done to enable more reliable electricity connection. There are things that can be done at a provincial level. And in our view, over a period of 5 years, 600,000 figures, very realistic.
You also speak about supporting of small businesses. Current government will tell you that a lot of money is invested in supporting SMEs, right? They will mention all these institutions that exist from IDC to CIFA. Provincially, there's GEP, I think, and several others. Mm. So they would argue, but what are you talking about? And they would actually show you hundreds of entrepreneurs who say, well, I have received a check, and here I am today.
Mm. Look, I mean, I think there's a number of contributing factors that enable or hamper entrepreneurship, right? One of them, and I think it was Skinny Sboo, the sock guy, who said, you know, stop giving me mentorship, give me money.
Yes.
And
I
you
agree
know,
with him.
And the truth is, that is a massive issue. Access to low-cost capital at scale for entrepreneurship and venture capital, right? We don't have a dedicated pool of venture capital that just exists out there for entrepreneurs. And we also have what I'd call a small business kind of mindset or culture. Now, small business is fine, but ultimately the job of a business is to grow.
Mm.
So the idea is not to stay small forever. The idea is that you start small, but ultimately must be scalable. So there must be a pipeline for you, both in terms of the market that you are trading in, as well as the amount of capital available to you to enable you to scale, right? And government must be a player in all of that. So even if you look at the likes of NEF, which is a fantastic institution, they've done great things. But the NEF is undercapitalized in terms of the portion of grant funding they receive from Treasury. And what this then means is that the NEF now needs to go to the same capital markets that the Absa banks and the Standard banks and all of them go to. And they need to borrow at the same rates as everybody else. And then they still need to make a bit of money. So that means they come, by the time you and I walk in with a proposal, the NEF is actually probably going to charge you. Your lending rate is going to be higher than what you would have gotten at the bank, at a normal commercial bank.
You're talking to the converter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that is completely the opposite of what we should be doing. We should have a mechanism, enough mechanisms, and a deep pool of capital for entrepreneurs who have scalable businesses to be able to lend at 1%. They must be at a 1% rate. Why must they be lending at 14%, 13%, and so on and so forth? So this is what we are missing. We need cheap capital, and it needs to be close to where people are and available for people. And then, obviously, it's also not just about going around giving people free money, right? So there needs to be enough of the support. And I think that's where we have put a lot of our energies, in supporting businesses. But we talk about establishing what we call opportunity hubs. And opportunity hubs are about, you know, creating spaces where entrepreneurs or prospective entrepreneurs can engage with other entrepreneurs, business leaders, etc. And even those who are not going the entrepreneurship route, young people who want CV writing skills, interview skills, etc., they should also be able to come into such spaces and get access to those opportunities. And those are the types of ways in which we're looking at it.
I want us to conclude on the CREATE, but you speak about, you know, creating more classrooms so that they're not overcrowded and stuff. Again, the incumbent that you want to unseat will tell you that he's been opening a school almost every month since he's been in office, as actually MEC for education before he was premier. So he'll say, what are you going to do different?
Well, I can't comment on that. But what I can say is that we do have a massive issue of overcrowding in classrooms. And we have a challenge whereby, as I said to you earlier, with infrastructure, we had irregular expenditure of 101 million rand. We have only 52% of infrastructure projects that were scheduled were actually completed over the last year. So that means we are functioning at 50% capacity, essentially, from what we should be. And the question becomes, why is that? What is the logical reason that we just don't spend the budget that we have? You tell me. And I'm saying one of it, a big chunk of it goes to irregular expenditure and corruption. We just lose a lot to people's lifestyles. Okay? Number two is the project management and actually seeing those projects through to fruition and ensuring that, you know, they're meeting their targets and deadlines, etc. So we don't meet that. So while we may be doing a lot, we are still not even doing that which we could be doing. And I think our proposition, as I said, is very simple. We have a leadership issue. We have a management issue. We need to get in there and just from 52%, let's get it to 100%. And let's get the people in office who are capable and able to do that job.
Okay, Kay. So Rise is very vocal on this part. I've spoken to number of people in Rise, including the, call him what? You call him the national
leader.
The national leader.
the charming and wonderful song.
Speak a lot about this thing about care and about, you know, mental health. Mm. Please help me understand, why is this such a big thing to you and certainly to the country? Why does it matter so much? Because I don't hear it elsewhere.
Yeah.
You guys speak a lot about it.
Yeah, so, yeah, and that is, I think that's one of the C's is care. And care is really about a policy orientation that is focused on caring and prioritizing care for residents and citizens. And care spans across a number of different aspects. It is about childcare and caring about the development of our children. And that's critical. We talk about the first 1,000 days of a child's life being critical to their trajectory. I mean, one of the things that we've been talking about at a national level is the issue of hunger, for example. Did you know, Rams, that 27% of children under the age of 5 in South Africa suffer from stunting because they are hungry and they are just not getting enough food? And in many of our engagements, most of them, in fact, when we are in communities and you ask people, when last did you eat? You hear people saying they last ate yesterday, some 2 days ago. People are just hungry out there. And it's a topic nobody talks about. And we're saying, before we start having these high-level discussions about job creation, unemployment, how can a person even be expected to go to work if they're hungry? So we have to deal with that issue. And the fundamental, let me say, unit of care is to feed people, to house people, to make sure that they have access to good health care, and to make sure that children are safe and cared for and have facilities just to be able to enjoy their childhood in the communities where they live. And it's not something of our own imagination. This is a result of, you know, when you actually sit and engage and look the residents of this province in the eye and you ask them what matters most to them, they will tell you that. They will say, I'm hungry, I haven't eaten today, my children haven't eaten today. And one of the things I worry about is the fact that our kids have nowhere to play because there are no recreational facilities in our community. Or mothers are unable to even go to work and have jobs because they fear for the fact that they have to leave their children at home with strangers. We talk about, for example, the country likes to have we have a meltdown every year when that report comes out about children not being able to read for meaning. How can they read for meaning if we are not investing in early childhood development? And if their parents are nowhere to be found because they have to go and work, you know, 14 hours a day, travel
another four hours
a day, etc., etc. So having a policy orientation that centers care is about humanizing policy. It's about looking at the things that matter the most to people and ensuring that the basic human needs are taken care of across the board. It must be. We cannot sacrifice people's basic human rights and our own humanity on the basis of affordability. So what we have to be doing, and this is why this plan is an integrated plan, we have to grow the economy. The only way that we fund the social welfare and the social safety net, which is mandatory, is if we can ensure that we are growing the economy. We grow the economy by ensuring that one tax money, the bit that we already have, we're actually using it for the right things, investing in infrastructure, getting Eskom back on track, et cetera, et cetera. We can't talk about these things in silos. They are all integrated into each other. And at the center of it is the ability to have a leadership that can look at it in an integrated way. I just want to make one last little comment. And it's on the topic of sort of integrated and systemic leadership, right? System leadership. We engaged with some of the top nonprofit organizations who are running food programs in communities as we were developing our policies. And they shared with us that one of their biggest challenges is the fact that food provision, just as a thing in our country, sits across 3 different government departments. So the decision making, the food that gets to our table and the policies that affect that sits across 3 different departments. So there is a disjuncture between policymaking even when you just want to talk about food. And this is a typical thing in how our government is organized. Look at electricity. Electricity is sitting in, I think, also 3 different departments. Ministry of Electricity,
Public Enterprises.
It's also sitting at Eskom. Mm-hmm. There's a whole board there. So who is actually driving that strategy? Who is accountable for that strategy? Where does the buck stop when it comes to electricity provision? It is not a wonder that we don't have electricity, because it is completely fragmented and there's no systemic integration between all of these different arms that are talking to each other. So in looking at this document, I implore you not to read it as standalone sections, but to understand that we see all of these things as integrated and affecting each other. And to be able to create a true economy and a country that cares, we have to be able to solve for the jobs issue, the economic growth issue, et cetera, et cetera.
It seems to me, and certainly sounds to me like, if you took over and you dealt with these issues, you would then create a new cohort of people who would be stunting, because you would have taken money from politicians who are eating every day, and they were stunting. Anyway, let's move on to the final C of your plan, cooperate. Is this where you concede that you won't win, then therefore you have to cooperate with others?
No, this is where we acknowledge the role of cooperative governance in the very system of our government. It's how it's designed. There's an entire section in our constitution that is dedicated to cooperative governance. And it's also sorely lacking. And it's in our view, it is the next frontier of governance that we really need to focus on. Because, as you know, we have, you know, the three spheres of government, but also at a provincial level, we have 11 municipalities, all likely to now find themselves being governed by different parties. Mm. So we have to move now out of a majoritarian mindset into a cooperative mindset. This idea that the governing party has, that the only way they can govern is if it's only them governing, you know, is actually counter to how our system is designed and how our constitution envisioned our country functioning. And so cooperative governance and our commitment to cooperate is saying exactly that. We are coming into a system where we understand, and myself as Premier, I will be coming in with a deep understanding of the fact that we have 11 different municipalities, there will be different governments in all of them. But if we are truly serious about centering the citizens, and we have to get our local municipalities functioning again, it's not about me coming and wanting to impose the Tsuga plan on every single one of those 11 municipalities, but about creating forums, enough adequate forums for cooperation, such that, and by the way, Gauteng is the smallest province of them all, by the way. Mm. It's the smallest one,
okay, by landmass,
geographically,
yes,
with the highest population, right? But as small as it is, you need to be able to have a consistent strategy between Ekurhuleni, city of Joburg. These things are like 30 minutes from each other. Mm. These places are 30 minutes from each other. You can't say you're going to have functioning public transport in city of Joburg and then dysfunctional in Ekurhuleni. So you need an integrated approach. And that's why, again, our view is that we haven't done enough of that. But it's a function of the fact that we have had this kind of one-party dominance for so much time. We have to now focus on cooperative governance, create those forums, and get parties around the table that are willing to work together.
You know, in defense of this one party that you keep on referring to, dominance, there's another party that's dominating. And actually, they just told you not to come into that space. Like, you guys must stay away. Like, you know, come and steal here. Don't steal in their
province.
Yes,
absolutely.
So it's not only just... It seems to be a political thing.
I didn't name names in that. I'm talking about a culture of one-party dominance. If the shoe fits.
Yeah. So, but some argue, though, as we conclude the cooperation part, that we actually do not need the middle tier, the tier that you're gunning for now, the province.
Look, that is a debate that is ongoing, and we have not taken a policy position as far as getting rid of the provincial layer. But I certainly think there's a conversation to be had about how we bring governance closer to people and have much more participatory democracy and create mechanisms for people to feel like real shareholders of this democracy. And so the most of us, our lived experience of government's efficacy is what we experience in our local municipality. You know, when you've got potholes and all of those things and your lights are off, largely it's local government mm-hmm. that is to blame for that. Yet we tend to obsess about a lot of what happens at national level, etc. However, I do think that province does have an important role to play, personally. And I think the competencies that the province is responsible for are right, you know, because if you're going to do, if you need to think about long-range spatial planning or infrastructure development, it cannot be something that is just done at a municipal level. You have to be able to budget for it and plan for it at a much grander scale. One, for it to be economically viable, but two, for it also to be integrated and coherent across the province. If we're going to expand the Gautrain line, it needs to go through various municipalities, et cetera, et cetera. And there needs to be a way to ensure that that coordination happens. And I think it's right that that happens at the provincial level. Similar with education. It shouldn't be that you have one municipality where the education is outstanding and then 30 minutes down the road, it's not. And again, I think education as a competence is right to be sitting at a provincial level. But in saying that, I do think that parents and citizens must be involved in student governing bodies, and they must be vocal and present and attend those AGMs and meetings.
They're at work. They have no public transport to get there for those meetings at 5 o'clock.
Very true. Very true. But those are now
every time I hear this criticism, I people are not cognizant of the fact that I am. My mother could never ever come to a school meeting.
Me personally, I'm the same. Me personally, I cannot go to a school meeting because I'm busy here chatting to Borams. But but
national duty.
But the point is that is now what we need to be solving for and saying, how do we now create and the enabling environment for parents to be more actively involved and give them the platforms to be able to be part of school governance at a much more substantive level. So I think for me, there is a role for province to play, and it is certainly in the much more macro long-term planning and the disbursement, you know, of course, national budgets at a sort of programmatic level rather than at a project level.
You know, premiers in Gauteng, at least two of them, have had signature projects that actually got to name them after them. You know, Mbazima Shilowa had the Shilowa Express that we now know as the Gautrain. And now we have Amapanyaza. What will be your signature project that's going to be known as the Voice or something?
No, I'm not going to. It's not about signature projects. I have put a name on my plan. It is called Tsoga GP. We are going to revive this economy.
And what happens if you don't make it?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I haven't really spent too much time on that. I think I foresee a coalition government anyway happening in the province. Mm-hmm. So I do foresee Rais Mzansi and myself playing some role in that government of the province. Whether they select me to be premier or not is neither here nor there. But I think Rais Mzansi will definitely have a seat at the table in a provincial government.
Would you serve as an ordinary legislator? Backbench.
Well, you know what? I would be willing to, but I think
that would be bad economically for you.
I think what's important is to note also in my role as national chair of the party, I do have other responsibilities, and I think the party would need to make that determination when the time comes.
So if Panyaza prevailed and you didn't make it and came to you and said, Nasi Spani, what did you say?
I would say no thank you, because I know that my contract will end just after elections.
Finally, why should we vote for you?
I think that, you spent quite a lot of time reading my CV.
And everything that you've written, listen to every tape I could listen to.
It's not only about that, but it's really about the fact that I think this province needs leaders who genuinely are, one, committed to doing this work, not for their own self-enrichment, but for the benefit of the province and the citizens, Number two, we need leaders who have actually done these things and built things and, you know, who have a track record that we can point to and say, this is what they've done. Maybe they've never necessarily led in politics, but we can point to other things that they've done where they've executed successfully. We don't have the luxury of the next 10 years or even 20 years. And I think we have to make a choice now to usher in a cohort of leaders who at the very least have a level of a track record of delivery in their spaces. And I think that I would be a solid candidate for this province. And if you've ever seen me put my mind to anything, those who know me would know that there are very few things that I put my mind to that I don't succeed at. And I certainly have put my mind to this one.
Ladies and gentlemen, Vuyiswa Ramakgopa, who is not related to anybody with that surname that we know, thank you very much for the time and all the best. By the way, you are one of the three women who are vying for the premiership of Gauteng, which says a lot about Gauteng. That's great. All the best.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure, and it's been a pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Taking the Rams by the Horns. Please send your comments to me via email on rams@ramsmabote.com. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Please share your views on what you think possessed Vuyiswa Ramakgopa to enter politics. Download the My Sowetan app and listen to more of my podcasts. We are also on Spotify. Follow us on X @RamsByTheHorns and @SowetanLive. From me, Rams Mabote, goodbye and God bless.